25 years is a long time to hold a resentment, Joe.
It's not a resentment at all.
It's bothered you for 25 years?
It has bothered me. It's a mystery more than a resentment.
It has puzzled you.
Oh, it still puzzles me. And I don't know if I can get any closure, but it's something from my past.
Your past, it's not something that we can all relate to?
Oh, I think a lot of people can relate. In fact, it made national news at the time.
Oh, so it's not your, I didn't graduate high school or something like that? It's not something very personal for you?
No.
I'm trying to think of, the year would have been 83, 82, somewhere in that area. I mean, is it exactly 25 years or?
I think the actual incident was about 84 when it happened.
Okay.
And
what happened?
Well, what happened, and this is going to sound a little strange, but Bigfoot came to my house.
Not at all, Joe.
And it made national news.
It did. Read it right here. And see, the reason I bring this back up now is because they wrote an article about it in Sports Illustrated in 1986. And only now has Sports Illustrated opened up their vaults to where you could go back and search for this stuff.
Oh, I saw that this weekend.
And I had kind of, this has become kind of something I wasn't even sure if I dreamed or not, but I distinctly remember talking to this gentleman about Bigfoot coming to my house, and then they went on to write an article about this in Sports Illustrated.
When you say your house, what do you mean?
Read that paragraph. That's my house this guy is describing.
Joe Downham, that's not you, Joe.
That was my neighbor, and that's part of the mystery, because I'd love to find him again, and I've looked, and I can't do it. I
haven't. Well, in 1983, he was a retired toolmaker.
Yes, he was getting up there in age even then.
So today, he's probably...
He might have passed on, but I've searched for any Downhams in this area that might know more about this story.
Joe Downham, a resident of Eastgate, that's where you lived.
Yes.
A wooded rural community. Eastgate was a wooded rural community back then?
It was, yes.
I don't want to live all the way out in Eastgate. Takes a wagon, a paddle boat, 2 days to get there.
Eastgate was the edge of where the buses came and stuff when I first moved here. When I lived in Issaquah, there was one light, and it was a flashing one. I mean, there was not much out there.
According to Joe Downham, at about 1 o'clock on a summer morning in 1983, he returned home from working a swing shift, decided to water his garden. While doing so, he first heard and then saw a huge, weird-looking creature skulking around Downtown Joe's house?
Yes.
A neighbor's house.
And you weren't skiing at that time, so it wasn't you.
I wasn't even in the country, and I'll tell you more about that, but go ahead and read the rest of his encounter.
Joe says, at first I thought it was a werewolf.
Oh, that's it at first. Right. Until I discovered it was much worse.
Not another werewolf. I thought we sprayed for those.
This is documented stuff.
This is your nutty, retired toolmaker neighbor, huh?
Well, read on. All right.
At first I thought it was a werewolf, says Downham. But then I figured, maybe it's just a peeping Tom.
By the way, Harry werewolf, Stevie. Peeping Tom, is quite a gap between those two. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the hairy aspect is the same problem. Right?
On approaching to within 30 feet of it, however, he quickly changed his opinion when he saw that the creature was standing upright on 2 feet. He saw a creature standing upright on 2 feet in Eastgate?
Looking into my window.
Looking into a window 7.5 feet above the ground. Oh, you measured the window afterwards.
Well, that's why I would look. I don't know if this gentleman is alive, but unfortunately for me, the mid-80s were about the most lost point of my life, the brain cell-wise and everything.
Yeah.
When I was out of the country. I was in New Zealand. This is when I was chasing an old love. I came back semi-distraught from that, and... It turns out I went over to this guy's house because my dad says, you're not going to believe.
You just missed Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Or a peeping Tom or maybe a werewolf.
I guess there were guys out there taking casts of the footprints and the whole thing.
Now, really?
Yeah, I was gone for 2 months.
This was at your house?
This was at my
house.
You
never told us this before.
In my backyard. Well, it's been bothering me for years. Because I remember, this was 2 years after the fact that this article came out about it. And I had lost this Sports Illustrated, and I'd gone online searching for information, and I thought, maybe I just dreamed this whole dang thing.
Wait a minute. You heard that Sports Illustrated put their archives online, and you went to search for this weekend, and that's why you have it.
Yes, that is exactly.
This is the article from January 6th, 1986.
Yes. See, I was starting to even doubt my memory of the whole incident. Like, maybe it was something I dreamed.
And you thought if you told us, we'd just, like, ridicule you.
Yeah, but it's bothering me.
Oh, why would you think that?
What would make you think that?
Something on eBay, maybe, to sell something from your old house to make some money out of this?
No. It's just a real mystery of my life that I uncovered just the tiniest. I couldn't even remember this old guy's name, and I recovered
this. Let me get you this article. Really goes. This was your house that made the paper.
Yeah, you could ask my dad about it. And I had asked him, and he never really knew many details.
Well, you know, smart people don't continue to tell the story at the time Bigfoot visited their house.
Trying to catch me in the shower.
That's why your younger brother's so hairy. Here's the story. On approaching to within 30 feet, he saw the creature standing upright and looking into a window, which was later measured to be 7.5 feet above the ground. At this point, Downham began to think Squatch. The figure was generally apish, but its head was large and pumpkin-shaped and covered with matted brown hair. A moment later, the creature was joined by a companion, a somewhat smaller beast with darker hair and a more pointed head. Something must have disturbed them, and the bigger one let out a tremendous call like a wolf. It was actually one note rising and falling. Both retreated as Downham fled into his house and scarily locked the doors. Another Washington resident, whom we shall call Mrs. X, wisely did not give her name, agreed to talk about her Squatch encounters only after being promised anonymity. She says she does not want to be thought a fruitcake, particularly by her husband. And hers is a quiet community with many retired people. Just the mention of such a thing would send our town into terror. But she said, I have seen Squatches on several occasions. They are manlike, but bear-sized, or bigger. They are extremely cautious. They have very good hearing. They sound like elephants moving around. The animals also seem to her to be peaceful and extremely shy. And she says she doesn't want to give more details or their whereabouts because she doesn't want to see them harmed, studied by science.
And apparently there was some study that went on. See, I was out of the country for almost 3 months, and my dad at the time was also not staying at the house. He was staying mostly at his...
Joe, you don't really believe there's a Squatch, do you?
I've always believed.
You have. Look at the article goes on and goes, hundreds of reports of Squatches walking upright on two large feet. But here's the part. I mean, they are very adaptive. Forests, mountains, prairies, deserts, wetlands. They've been in densely populated areas on Long Island, New York, the suburbs of Baltimore, Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
That was me. Now, that one was me.
How do they get around, Joe? Do they, like, pretend they're in a Geico commercial or as one of those cavemen and take a flight?
All I know is that in 1983, there was enough people convinced that something had been in my backyard, that they were out there measuring the prints.
And taking plaster casts.
Yeah, and that's the guy who saw them, was a guy named Joe Downham, who I can't find, and he may have been passed on, and I may never. But it's, you know, it's something that has bothered me for a long time.
Joe downloaded this weekend from the Sports Illustrated Vault, which just came online.
Yeah, you can now go back and see. I'd searched every which way that I knew how to Google. Bigfoot, Sports Illustrated. I couldn't remember this gentleman's name, or I would have put that in there. It might have come quicker.
They call them GUFOs, like G-U-F-O. What does that stand for?
I don't. Well, unidentified.
They say the world. Well, they say the world's most famous GUFO is the Loch Ness Monster. And Sasquatch is another, and they call them goofologists, appropriately probably, that believe in this sort of a thing. There's been some American water monsters, too, and then Sasquatch.
But yeah, that's what it's been, and it's something I kind of, like a lot of things, I guess, in your youth, that you just kind of push down there, in there, and you don't think about it for a long time, and I heard that the vault went online, and I dug that up, and now it's bothering me all over again.
You just, what did you search for? Bigfoot? Squatch?
Yes.
You searched Sports Illustrated for
Bigfoot. Bigfoot ability to rebound. Why the Houston Rockets made him the number one selection in the NBA draft.
Ironically, it's the first Sports Illustrated. I think Mike Tyson was on the cover back when he was still very on the rise at the time.
All right. Let's see. I don't know if anybody out there knows this guy, Joe Downham.
Yep, he was in Eastgate. I lived on 146th Avenue. He lived right behind me, and there was a Bigfoot in my yard, or so he said.
Liquor store owner Gabe Fedunke of Durango, Colorado, has a lot of problems with shoplifters. Police say, well, Gabe's tactics for dealing with shoplifting have caused him the trouble he's in now. When Gabe catches a shoplifter, he orders them to either face prosecution or surrender one of their shoes. He then displays the shoes in his store, much like a restaurant would display a bad check. He did that until last week when police informed him that what he was doing could be considered felony robbery.
Wow. Stealing liquor is only a misdemeanor, but what he's doing in retribution is actually a harsher crime, they say.
Gabe Fedunke, welcome to the Bob Rivers Show. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. Good to be here.
You're in Durango, Colorado right now.
Yeah, I am.
This is where your store is.
Correct.
Now, if I understand the story correctly, you don't steal the shoes from the kids. You say, I'm going to prosecute you. If you would wish not to be prosecuted, then give me one of your shoes.
Yeah, in a nutshell, that's pretty much it.
Well, if they freely give you their shoe in a private deal between you and them not to prosecute them, how could you be accused of a crime?
Well, I think where the police were coming from is that I think unless the person maybe signed something or something to that effect, then it's still, you know, I'm giving them, you know, the opportunity, but I'm still holding that against them. I'm holding the police call against the whole situation. So basically, they consider extortion.
I think the police should be giving you a medal for keeping our courts clear of miscreants and teaching them a little something that they learn voluntarily.
Yeah, you know, personally, I thought that basically those people, you know, had a chance, and I gave them a really good chance at not having the police involved. You know, saving taxpayers money.
I'm totally with you. I can't imagine anybody that wouldn't be. I'll tell you what. Would you like to hear from our audience whether they are on your side or not?
That'd be great.
1-800-252-1025. The story. Shoe store. Gabe is the proprietor.
Liquor store.
Oh, did I say?
It's turning into a shoe store.
Yeah. Soon.
Slowly.
Thank you very much. The liquor store. And by the way, do you have security cameras and such?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them. I've got these on tape also.
So you have evidence, and you probably have a video record of you talking to the kid and the kid freely handing over his shoe.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like I said, not, you know, all walks of life. I've got...
Can you fix this by just putting a form for them to sign saying, I freely give my shoe to my good friend Gabe Fedunke?
I have basically looked into that, and we're pursuing that route right now. But we definitely, you know, we already have something in case that doesn't work. I created the Wheel of Consequence, which is like the Wheel of Fortune. You spin it, and whatever it lands on is going to be your punishment.
And how often do you have a shoplifter?
It depends on how much how much work I do. So a lot of times if I just don't work on at the desk here, I actually pay attention to the security cameras. I can catch, you know, people every other day, if not, you know, a couple a day sometimes.
How many people do you think get away with it?
I think probably, if I'm not here really being diligent, I bet you 50 to 80% get away.
Now, there's a danger that goes into pursuing a criminal. If it's a person that's stealing liquor, I'm assuming they're a little bit desperate and probably really wanting that liquor. Are you worried about your safety? I mean, chasing a guy down the street for a bottle of booze could cost you your life.
Yeah, you know, I've been told that it's not the smartest thing to do, but at the same time, I, you know, evaluate the situation. You do a little profiling when you look at the person, and you deem whether they are, I guess, one of those type of people that might shoot you. But, you know, I really, if the person looks like they're tougher than I am, and
so some people have gaydar, you have gundar.
You know, who knows what they ever have. And, you know, a lot of times they'll try to throw you down and try running, and it's, you know, part of the experience. You decide whether to give it up, let them run, and then just call the cops, or you know, that seldom happens, but at the same time I judge whether that could happen, and then I, you know, decide to call the cops or still give them the opportunity to give up a shoe and hit the road.
Gabe, I've been to Durango. I've actually spent some time there, and it strikes me as sort of an artistic resort town, more or less.
It is, but you still have got to, you know, we love it. The transients love it also. You know, a lot of these guys that come in here are transients just wandering through town and notice that there's a little liquor store, a little boutique liquor store right in the heart of the town. And, of course, they say, hey, this is easy pickings right here. They're not going to
Describe for me, if you would, the shoes hanging on the wall. Do you have a sign up there like that, like they do with the bad checks? What am I going to see when I come into the store that's going to be a deterrent for me?
Well, let's see here. Basically, all the articles that have been coming out lately are one big deterrent for one, but I actually have been told to give the shoes back to their rightful owners. Legally, I have to go and hand these shoes back to their owners to make it right.
When you had these displayed, were they behind some glass or something? Because these are the type of people that probably have some pretty well-worn shoes, and I'm guessing the smell of these isn't helping, you know, your place any.
I'm not going to lie, a couple of them smelled pretty bad. We had to deodorize them, and you know, we set them up high enough where the customers don't get too much smell coming down.
All right. Are you all for this? I think this guy should be allowed to do it. I think he should get an attorney and defend his right to keep the shoes that were freely given to him. Does everybody agree?
I agree. I would suggest, Gabe, that you have him sign the shoe as they give it up. That'll be your contract.
I'm never for vigilante justice. I just want to
You're
go
not?
On record. No, I'm for when there's laws broken, you call the authorities. That's what they're there for.
All right, let's go to the phones. 1-800-252-1025. So you would prosecute Gabe?
I would strongly.
I mean, all Gabe is doing is saying, "Hey, dude, I'm going to give you a chance. You give me one of them shoes, maybe that'll teach you a lesson." I mean, he's being a kind guy, a kind store owner, not giving people a criminal record.
Let's see how kind he is. You said your wheel of consequences is your new thing. What kind of consequences do you have now that you can't take shoes?
Well, I'm up for opinions, but basically we've got a couple. One of them is shave an eyebrow.
I was going to go with half a mustache or one eyebrow.
This is all great stuff.
It starts at eyebrows and then it becomes fingers, Gabe. I know your type.
Well, I think that, you know, in Pakistan they probably, you know, take the foot and the shoe.
Well, all right, 1-800-252-1025. Let's take a quick poll of the audience. Riley, is this a great guy, a wonderful store owner, giving kids a second chance, or is he as the police accuse, a felon?
No, I think he's a great guy. I think that, you know, there's an ultimatum, and young kids, you know, do stupid things. They shouldn't always be just prosecuted for something that can ruin them in the long run. But in the same time, they are still taking a punishment. Like, wow, now I got to give up one of my shoes. I'm a young kid. I don't have that much money. These are my favorite pair of shoes. And it does keep the courts free of, you know.
And he's not
problems.
Trying to profit from this, or he'd take both shoes. Thank you.
In theory, we're talking young kids and shoes. I'm seeing him hold up an old boot that probably came from a 60-year-old wino. I mean, it's not all young kids with nice shoes, is it, Gabe?
Yeah, we've got all, you know, all walks of life. It just depends on the mood the person's in. You know, sometimes people make bad decisions, and unfortunately, occasionally, I'm there to be the guy that lets them know that wasn't the great idea. It's really humiliating that people don't want to have that happen again. So
sure, absolutely. I think it's fantastic. Greg, I don't even think you're breaking the law. I just think you need an attorney. Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the guy's well within his rights to be able to take their shoes. You know, the Bible
not take
says,
their shoes. Not but hold on, he's not taking their shoes. He's saying, "Would you like to give me a shoe so I don't call the cops?"
And I think that's fair.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if they're going to steal from him, they should cough up something in return.
All right, and George in Tacoma, George.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, I believe giving a shoe is just like a plea bargain, like anything else in a system. If the guy wants his shoe back, maybe he can bring the store owner bottle of booze.
Something like that would be good. David in University Place.
Yeah, I was just calling to say, you know, I think it's just the town and the city. They just want to come down and get the court costs, you know, there so that they can make their money on their end.
They want these courts clogged up with junk like this.
Exactly.
Interesting. Bobby in Kent. Go ahead, Bobby.
Hey, good morning, Bob. Good morning, gang. Cock-a-doodle-doo.
Welcome.
My comment was, now that the word is out, I'm just wondering if he realizes the influx of shoplifters he's asking for. Because, you know, before I was 18, 19 and looked like I could pass, I would have gladly thrown on a pair of last year's sneakers on Friday night just for the chance to steal a bottle.
That's my concern, is that people are going to start coming with lesser shoes.
Sure.
Not caring.
I trade last year's Fila for a chance at a bottle of whiskey.
Well, and any store that cracks down on shoplifters runs the risk of, I dare you to shoplift at this store. Yeah. Speak to that,
right,
Gabe.
Yeah, basically, I think that, you know, the floodgates could be open. People are going to hide shoes behind my store in the alley and then come in and ransack the place and then go out and say, hey, here's my shoe. I'm going to go get my other one and back. I'll be in 10 minutes.
You're on a shoes for booze exchange program.
Todd says it's a great policy, but other stores have tried similar tactics. Like what, Todd?
Yeah, this is Todd. I heard a story not long ago. A gal at a candy store on the East Coast, and there were kids stealing candy. And she basically, when she'd catch them, she'd put a T-shirt on them and said, I stole from the store, and they'd have to come back and work and work the candy off. And it thought it was a great story, and everybody loved it. But one parent got involved in a lawsuit. Next thing you know, the store owner was in court. I think it's really too bad that owners can't try and hold people accountable. Good luck in Durango there.
Yeah, he's giving you props. I believe John will, too. John is in Enumclaw. John, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the eye for an eye thing is Old Testament, but in the New Testament it says that a person should always take up their argument with the person personally. It should never involve an outside source unless absolutely necessary.
Definitely.
That was sort of the don't gossip section of the Bible, though. I don't think it meant stealing. John, thank you.
It goes for more than that.
All right, John, thank you very much. Ed in Arlington is going to be our last caller. Ed also says he likes the idea. Go ahead, Ed.
I like the idea because when people do see that person heading down the street with no shoe on, they know what that person's all about.
The only thing I don't like about it, thank you, Ed, is the better you get at this, the more rotten you make your town look, the more shoes hanging in your store, the more it looks like a terrible place to raise my family. So I just keep four or five shoes up, you know, the most current ones.
Current last five, yeah.
All right, Gabe, are you going to get a lawyer, or are you going to fight this, or are you just going to...
I'm not going to fight it, but I am going to just talk to my lawyer just to make sure that I can still, humiliate these guys a little bit so that I can continue some sort of tactic that is a little more creative than your normal calling the cops. You know, it's going to save taxpayers money. It's going to be more humiliating than just getting a misdemeanor ticket and, you know, walking down the street. So it's one of those things that I'm going to pursue different, you know, methods, alternatives to this. As long as they're within the law, I'm good for it.
A New York lawyer is suing Delta Airlines for $1 million, saying that his family vacation turned into a nightmare after they were stranded in an airport for days and treated disdainfully by airline employees. Richard Roth filed his lawsuit on behalf of himself and his mother. He says he had planned his Christmas 2007 trip to Buenos Aires to celebrate his mother's 80th birthday. She had grown up there but had not returned in years. Instead of a great vacation, what happened is a nightmare. We'll let him tell you. Richard Roth, welcome to the Bob Rivers Show. How are you?
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Okay, you're in New York City now.
I'm in New York, in literally midtown Manhattan.
All right, and so Buenos Aires, that's a long trip. It's expected to be a somewhat difficult to get down there, right? You can't fly direct, can you?
You can fly direct. There's many airlines that offer direct flights.
Oh.
I think American does, and I know from New York, and as well as Aerolíneas Argentina, which is an Argentine airlines.
But you had booked Delta Airlines, and give me the give me just the blow by blow of when you decided that things were not being handled appropriately.
Yeah, I'll give you the if you will. I was flying. The flight was supposed to be from Westchester to Atlanta, from Atlanta then to Buenos Aires. While I was in the airplane from Westchester to Atlanta, I was met with I asked the woman, "Can you tell me what gate I'm going to be going to catch my connecting flight? And is it delayed? Because I was a bit delayed from Westchester to Atlanta." And she was rude and obnoxious. Her name I'll never forget was Brittany, and I was somewhat taken aback by her just lack of friendliness. But that was okay. I thought maybe she had a bad day or whatever for whatever reason. I didn't really make a big deal of it. So we landed, and we didn't have a lot of time, but we ran to the gate in Atlanta going to Buenos Aires. My son, being 16 years old, ran quicker than I did. We get there out of breath. My mom, my 80-year-old mom, was behind us. And my son says to the gate agent, the guy in charge of the gate, is this the flight to Buenos Aires? And he says to my son, it's already left. My son says, well, what's that airplane I'm looking at? And nicely. And he said, oh, it's there. It's here. But you can't get on. My son and I then said, well, why can't we get on? He said, well, the door to the airplane is closed. Unbeknownst to the gate agent, we had about 20 people meeting in Buenos Aires. So I had a cousin on the plane that I was about to board.
Well, wait a minute. Were you late for the connection or on time for the?
I was not. You know, it's, I don't know if it's black or white. I definitely was there on time long before the people. They closed the door at the gate, but the door to the airplane was open.
Right, but that's usually. But it's in the fine print that 10 minutes before the flight they close the door. Usually, right?
But it was not. It was more than 10 minutes before the door was closed. And it was their connecting flight.
Before we get too far, because this is all going to come up in court. You're a lawyer. You ought to know. I'm going to want to know a little bit more than rude and obnoxious. What did Brittany say specifically that put you off?
Well, what Brittany said, and I don't have a problem telling you all this because I've documented it to Delta. I didn't want to commence this lawsuit. I do not. I'm at the Roth Law Firm in New York. I don't sue airlines. I've never done it before in my life. I don't do personal injury litigation. I'm a commercial litigator. So
okay.
The reason why this is different is because this is not what I do. What Brittany said was when I first left from at Westchester, I said, can you tell me what time, what gate we're on and how the flight's doing to Buenos Aires? And she said to me, I don't know now. I will let you know when we get closer.
That sounds reasonable. Yeah. Wow.
Totally reasonable.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Totally reasonable. So we get closer. We're about, you know, somewhere within a half an hour, 20 minutes of being in Atlanta. I asked her, I said, well, Brittany, now that we're closer, can you tell me? She said, I already told you the answer. I said, no, you told me when we got closer, you would know. And the people around me, they were looking at her. And she says, no. And I said, well, what did you tell me? She said, I told you what gate. I said, can you tell me again? Because maybe I forgot. The guy next to me is looking at her like she has three heads. She said no, and she walks away. I then press the light to call her, and another person comes in. There were two people, and it's a small plane. And he says, she said she told you already. I said, all I want to know is give me the gate and give me the time. It's not a difficult thing. So she just wouldn't tell me. Yes, she said she'll tell me later. Then she wouldn't tell me later, claiming she told me earlier.
Okay. I'm annoyed with her already, too.
Yeah.
And so now, when your plane lands, though, obviously it was late because you didn't make the connection.
But here's the reason why Delta is wrong. As I'm at the gate, I have a cousin on the plane who's literally walking in the plane door. And the guy, when the gate agent said to me, the plane door is closed, you can't get on. How many times can you question a gate agent? Because you can't see the plane when you're at the gate.
Right.
It's coincidentally, and luckily for me, I knew it. I pick up the phone, I call my cousin. I said, Jesse, is the door closed? Because I'm looking at the plane. She said, no, I'm actually standing in it. I said, really? She said, yeah, we're just starting to, we're not fully.
Ooh, that would tick me off, too. So the door to the plane was not actually closed, but they'd stopped.
Oh, it was wide open, and there were people just walking. They were still walking on the plane.
How long before the departure time was it at this point?
Well, it was at least 20 minutes before the departure time, at least.
Oh.
So I say to the gate agent, I say, Mr. Damore, can you talk to my cousin? Because maybe you don't know it. And I wasn't being an obnoxious New York lawyer. I can be, but I wasn't.
You can be. It's capable.
And the reason I wasn't, well, I'll tell you the reason why I wasn't. These guys are like lifeguards. If they want to kick you out of the pool, they can kick you out of the pool.
Right.
So I was overly nice. I said, can you talk to my cousin? She's on the phone here, and she's telling me the door's open. No, the door's closed. I said, well, Mr. Damore, I have five of us here. If I don't get out of Delta in Atlanta on December 20th, my goose is cooked. And so he said, the door's closed. I said, but and there's seats. And he said, and then I said to my cousin, are there seats available? She says, yes, there's seats available, and the door's wide open. So I said, can you go look? He leaves to the gate. He comes back, and he says to me, the pilot's in charge of the plane. I'm in charge of the gate. You're not getting on. I said, but Mr. Damore, I have my 80-year-old mother here. We ran. We want to get on this plane. We don't want to cause any stir. I know that if I don't get on this plane, it's going to be a hellish trip. And he says, you're not getting on. He smirks and he walks away. And the reason why I have him is because I was very fortunate to know that he was lying. The door was wide open in the plane.
Right, and you've got a witness who talked to you on a cell phone. You probably have a record of that cell phone call.
I have a record of the cell phone call. I have witnesses on the plane.
Oh, you're totally set. So why has Delta...
I even said to him, I said, Mr. Damore, if you're telling me that I can't get on for security reasons, like the gate door is shut and because of 9/11, I understand that. But if you're telling me the door to the plane is closed and it's not, then please let us... Please.
Okay, so now what I don't understand is why Delta, knowing all of this, hasn't flown you loop-de-loops around the world.
That's where it starts. Then there I am. The plane then takes off. And I don't want to get into it, but the bottom line is the time that they said it left the gate was different than the time, and the time it took off was different than the time it actually took off, which has got to be an FAA violation, because I have cell records showing us on the phone when they're saying the plane was in the flight.
Flight records and air traffic records will be flawlessly accurate, so you don't have to worry
about
that.
Does the FAA do that, or Delta do that?
Well, you can actually...
They have to file with the tower, right?
There is a website called flightaware.com. Are you familiar with that website?
I am not. I'm thank you.
Well, for just $100 an hour, I'll be happy to tell you about it.
Keep it in my way, Bob.
Yeah, I think.
Well, you'll just have to fly by to New York to testify at the trial.
I'm a lowly DJ. To me, that's fantastic money.
So let me just say what happened.
Go to flightaware.com. You can enter in the and I don't know if the record will still be there. It might be. You can enter in the flight and you can actually look at every bit of that flight.
I'll do all that, and I'll do that. In any event, so we then are stuck, and I say, they say, don't worry, you'll get on the flight, and they fly to Buenos Aires once a day. Don't worry, you're on the next flight out tomorrow. I say, great, one day, what's a big deal, right? I mean, it happens, it's unfortunate. I then find out that they've overbooked by 20-some people, and I'm number one on the wait list, and that they're, you know, there's no way I'm getting out the next day. They say, you know what, Mr.
What, did they put you up in a hotel?
They put me up in a hotel. Well, that's, I don't want to get into this too long, but what they do is at 12 o'clock at night or whatever it was, they say, take a voucher to the Holiday Inn. They don't tell you that they've given this voucher to thousands of people. I get to the hotel, and the door, the line to check into the hotel goes from the desk to the lobby to the carport into the parking lot. It's got to be 150 families trying to check into this hotel at 12 o'clock, 12:30 in the morning. So I go across the street. I just couldn't. You know, I have an 80-year-old mother. I have two kids. I just went across the street and paid for the hotel. That wasn't a big deal. But I get there the next day, and you know, they say to me, listen, you know, you're not getting on. You may not get on this plane. It wasn't even close. I wasn't getting on this plane. They were overbooked by 20-some passengers. I learned afterwards, and they say you're not. But we can get you out on January 8th. They say to me. It's December 21st. I have a son in high school, a daughter in middle school. I have paid for an entire trip in Buenos Aires. We can get you out on January 8th was not what I really wanted to hear.
Wow. Okay.
So I then say to them, well, can we try another airline?
So an airplane with plenty of empty seats took off.
Yes.
While you stood there.
Stood there.
And they destroyed your entire vacation. Okay, I'm assuming.
It gets worse. Let me get to the bad part.
Well, no, it gets worse. But here's what I did. I then call up Argentine Airlines, Aerolíneas Argentinas. I said, let me just try an airline. I mean, if any airline I'm going to try, it's going to be that. So I call up Aerolíneas. This is the night, you know, the second night after I'm not on the second flight. And they say to me, yeah, we have availability. We're leaving out of Miami the next day. You can just, we have five seats. I said, book them. Book me those five seats because I got to get to Buenos Aires because I have paid for hotel. I have my mother's at her homeland.
She's 90, right?
She's 80. She was 80 when you got there. She's 90 now.
Now she's 90.
Yeah. But, you know, kids that she grew up with, she was going to see at the age of 80. So it was a big deal. Her family, her parents, her whole family's down there. So and a lot of them, unfortunately, her brothers have passed away. Her mother and father have passed away. But she wanted to see cemeteries and, you know, just really try to visit her homeland. So I say to Delta, listen, can you get me to Miami? And they say to me, we can't get you to Miami. We can get you to Melbourne, Florida. I said, I'll take it. I'll take it anything to get to Miami. Melbourne, Florida, I didn't know it at the time, is about it's east of Orlando, so it's a 4-hour drive from Melbourne to Miami.
Yeah,
to Miami.
That's not too hateful.
So you're going to have to rent a car and drive to Miami.
Yeah, not bad. I said, listen, can you get my luggage to Melbourne? Sure, we'll get your luggage at Melbourne. I then fly from to Melbourne, land. Of course, there's no luggage. I rent a car, a big SUV, but there's no luggage in it. Drive to Miami, buy five new one-way tickets the day of to Buenos Aires.
Oh, I know what's coming now.
Okay, and then no, that was fine. The rest of that was fine. Then, yeah. Of course, I didn't get luggage until
Christmas. But Delta would have canceled your return flight. Wouldn't they?
Well, no, I made sure they didn't.
Okay, good.
I've flown. I said, listen, I talked to Delta. I said, just make sure you don't cancel my return flight because I'm not taking the initial flight because that's an issue. And they didn't. They got me luggage finally on Christmas Eve. So there I am. I leave on the 20th in Westchester, the evening of the 24th, literally 10 p.m. So that's the 20th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 5 days without luggage, not to mention the fiasco. So I am, and the rest of the trip went well.
Okay,
so
what do you want from them? Because we do have to wrap this up.
Here's what happens. I'll cut to the chase.
Okay. Our plane's leaving in a couple minutes.
Yeah, we need to have everybody on board.
Okay, here's the deal. February, I write him a letter. March, April, I write him a letter. Can you get me, reimburse me the money that I'm out? I'm out about $10,000, a little more than $10,000 for the airline tickets and the hotel and everything that was canceled. And they just say, we'll get back to you, we'll get back to you, we'll get back to you. So I finally sent him a complaint in May. I say, if you do not talk to me, I'm going to sue you. And I don't do this for a living. I don't sue airlines. They don't get back to me. I sue them, and it has become a cause célèbre. It has become a national issue, and that's because hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of people have had a similar experience. And at the end of the day, I had the luggage people, I had the flight attendant, I had the gate person, I had customer service after the fact. They don't care. They just don't care. And everyone has been, you know, it's gotten tremendous press because everyone feels for this, has had similar issues. And there's just no accountability. It's got to start at the top. You know, if every single department just doesn't care, from the guy who didn't let me on the plane to customer service never getting back to me, I said, I have to make a stand. And I still haven't. I sued them on the 23rd of May. They still haven't gotten back to me.
Not yet. So, Richard, in the end, you expect to get your $10,000, right? Even if you have to go to court for it.
In the end, I'm going to get my $10,000, and I'm going to tell the story. And if I can have one gate agent change his mind and not do what happened to me because of this lawsuit, then I feel like I've done something. I mean, this has gone from a little lawsuit of mine. Again, I don't do this. I do commercial litigation, securities, entertainment, sports, employment. I've never sued an airline in my life. I don't do personal injury litigation. But if this little lawsuit can change the way people have acted, then I'll be happy. I'll be happy. And you know, the millions of dollars, the $1 million, the hundreds of thousands of dollars, I don't know what's going to happen here, but I can tell you, I clearly...
You're already settling. I'm hearing hundreds of thousands now.
Well, no. The lawsuit, you should know, the lawsuit is for $275,000.
All right.
That's what's in the complaint.
I think you deserve every penny. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
It's just total lack of accountability.
Richard Roth, flightaware.com. Don't forget it. Thank you very much.
I will. Thank you very much.
Hey, big thing going on. One of the world's largest and most impressive collections of vintage aircraft has been quietly assembled in our area. But up until now, it has only been looked at by a privileged few. Paul Allen, it turns out, not only collects sports franchises, real estate, and rock and roll memorabilia, he also has a number of meticulously maintained aircraft from World War II. Adrian Hunt is the director of Paul Allen's Flying Heritage Collection, which features 15 of the most famous fighting planes of the World War II era. Many of you will want to see these planes. You can look at them. Is it in Everett, Adrian?
Yeah, it's in Everett, Washington, at Painfield.
All right. Everett Hunt, welcome to the Bob River Show. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Excited and busy this week.
This is a big week. Now, what day is the first day? June 6th?
June 6th, which is, of course, the anniversary of D-Day, and we'll be having a ribbon cutting, and we open to the public at noon on June the 6th.
Now, you've been working on this for a while, Adrian. How long?
We've been working on this sort of public facility for about a year now, trying to get it all ready and give a good place for the planes to get presented to the public and have some sort of educational exhibits, but still try and keep all the planes in a flyable condition in a hangar. So it's a complicated effort.
And that's the deal. These planes are not, like the Museum of Flight has lots of amazing things, too. Some of it's just hanging on a wire. But these, are every one of these safe to fly?
We fly about three quarters of them, and they're all sort of restored to flying condition. A couple of them are so rare that we don't fly them. But, the vast majority...
But they theoretically could fly in an emergency.
Probably all but one, if we're down to a pinch.
Which one should I not try to steal?
We have the Messerschmitt 163 Comet, which was amongst the most dangerous planes ever designed.
Even when it was flying, it was unstable. Is that what you're saying?
Right. The Germans at the end of the war came up with this rocket plane. So basically, you were put on the end of a stubby-nosed rocket, which fired up in the air at 700 miles an hour, had about 8 minutes' worth of fuel, and tended to explode at various times during its...
aimed it right at Church. Hill's ass. Every one of them.
So, now, and how, let's see, World War II, aviation was a huge part of this war. Isn't this the first war fought with airplanes?
Yeah, it was the first war where aircraft were really important. I mean, not just Pearl Harbor, but the bombing campaigns against the different countries, and of course the atomic bomb. It was the first time that aircraft really played an important role in a war.
As I look down these names of aircraft, some of them do look familiar, like the word Grumman. Is that a company that's still in business, or a lot of their planes flying?
Oh, dear. I'm not good at modern aircraft.
Oh, okay.
World War II.
Well, Mitsubishi now, I know they make plasma screen TVs. They made airplanes at one time.
They made the famous Zero Fighter. That's right.
That's right. And now, what is your, Adrian, are you like a curator of the museum?
Yeah, well, I'm the executive director. I'm sort of in charge of trying to make it all come together.
Are you also a pilot?
No, I'm not. My father was in the RAF in the Second World War, and I've always been interested in aircraft. But no, I'm not a pilot.
My flight instructor and I one time landed at Boeing Field, and I'm pretty sure it was one of these planes here because there was some plane being restored there, and he got off, and it was like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was as if he was in a trance, and he started walking towards this plane and stood in awe. Looking at it, and that's what aviators are going to do to this stuff, especially anyone old enough to remember the war and seeing these things fly. How close are they going to be able to get? Will they be able to sit in some of these planes? Is it like the boat show where you have to take off your shoes and put on these little booties?
No, we're not going to let you sit in a cockpit. But you can get pretty close to look at them in the hangar, and then every other weekend we're going to fly a couple of them, which is the real experience to hear and see those planes flying like they should have done.
Okay. Is there a website you can look and see when they're going to take off? Because that's another thing that's fun to watch.
Flyingheritage.com. Right. Yeah. We just launched a new website.
How did this collection get started? It's a pretty specific...
There's a really rich guy who can buy anything he wants on the planet.
I know that. But, I mean, how did Paul say, was there like a half a dozen of these that went up for auction at one time, and then he's got I've got a few pieces, so I need some more? I mean, it's 1935 to 1945. It's very specific things, and they're all like mint condition planes. It'd be pretty hard to accumulate this, so I would assume at some point there was one major purchase and then more have come in?
Well, it's more sort of a bit at a time. I think he's been collecting them for about a decade. He's very interested in, you know, history and historical preservation, and also in technology. And there was a tremendous surge in technology, you know, during that time period. You went from, you know, basically cloth-covered wooden-built biplanes to metal.
Right. The propellers were even made out of wood. In the beginning, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So. So those two things, the sort of history, and his father was a soldier in the Second World War. He landed on Omaha Beach and on D-Day. And so he was Paul's interest in the Second World War and the history of technology, and sort of put those two together, and he started collecting these planes. And then, you know, they've been restored slowly, and now we have a critical mass. And, you know, he likes to share things with the public, and, you know, as he does through many museums.
He's done the museum thing before, for sure. Yes, yeah. Eric.
Adrian, I assume that all of these planes have their original parts, because I'm always curious about the lifespan of machines. I know you can still drive old Model T Fords, for example, but airplanes are a little different than a car, because if they quit in the middle of a flight, you've got a big problem.
You do have a big problem, yeah. So basically, we try and use as many of the original parts as possible. If we can't use the original part, we remanufacture it an exact copy. You know, if it's material, we use the same thread count. If it's the metal, we try and use the same metal. You know, try and get the part exactly the same.
In other words, it's to original specifications.
Right. Sometimes you have to make minor you know, compromises just for safety and whatever. But
hey, Adrian, I got an idea for you.
Sure.
You're the boss, right? You're in charge.
Yeah, there you are.
Well, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, other than Paul Allen, of course, who's the real, you know, the big boss. But, I mean, and I don't know how close you are with Paul or whether you can ask him this or not, but this would really increase the turnout at your museum a lot. He has something that I want. He has, and I would go just to see it, although I'd love to sit in it. He has Captain Kirk's chair.
Oh.
And I don't see why have a flying museum without...
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Without Captain Kirk's chair there. If you have... Here's the thing. A lot of people will say, World War II, I don't care about it. Especially the younger iPod-wearing... And I'm sorry, they're not wearing Zunes, but they're iPod-wearing hippie generations. If you put Captain Kirk's chair, though, I think everyone will come.
Well, that's a great idea. Unfortunately, we don't want anything after 1945. But I guess he went back prior to 1945
right.
A couple of episodes.
Yeah. Just use Kirk's ass.
I guess. All right, well, maybe after you collect other famous spaceships,
you'll put together
the futuristic spaceship museum. Yes.
Adrian, I know Paul Allen is a local guy. I mean, his dad's a veteran. That's why, you know, the Northwest had so much to do with avionic superiority in World War II, and that did save the planet. Avionic, you know, air superiority saved the planet.
Saved us from Hitler.
No two ways about it.
No two ways
about it. Do you ever have to tell Paul that he can't do something with these planes? Does he ever want to just, you know, get in it, let's go, let's take that one, let's take this one? How do you tell that guy no?
Oh, he's never asked anything that we had to say no to.
In other words, so. We always say yes.
Yes, Paul.
Hey, did he ever make you listen to his music and you have to pretend you like it?
Oh, he's a good musician.
He's a great musician.
No, I'm lying. I bought his album.
Yes.
I liked his album, actually.
Did you like his album? Yeah, we all love it.
Love his football team.
He's a great guy, and when you get a chance, tell him thank you for all he does for the community.
Yeah, because he is trying to give back to the Northwest and Snohomish County and everybody.
He's the best. Adrian Hunt in Seattle. Adrian, we'll put up a link to the Flying Heritage Collection website right on our front page. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Is this Paul Allen's music?
No.
After the turn of the century, in the clear blue sky over Germany, came a roar and a thunder men have never heard. Screaming sound of a big war bird. Up in the sky, a man in a plane.
Dear Flabby, I have a bit of a dilemma. One of my best girlfriends works with me. I started working here first. Anyway, she came to the place where I work. And she always wants to chat with me about non-essential things. And she goes into way too much detail about the mundane. way too much. For example, it takes her 20 minutes to tell me something that ends up being nothing but a waste of my time. I really don't care. So far, I'm halfway into this letter, and I don't know what she's telling her about. This person doesn't give me enough details.
Typical of a woman, eh, Bob?
And she goes, exactly. And she goes into way too much detail about the mundane. 20 minutes, it's nothing but a waste of my time. I don't care about most of the stuff she's telling me. I don't need a play-by-play of every minute of her evening, weekend. I'm a personal, private person. I don't tell people these types of details about my life. I don't tell anyone. It seems like she can't keep anything to herself. I mean, if we didn't work together, would she instead call me every evening to give me the whole rundown of her life? I somehow don't think so. Do you think she's taking advantage of the fact that we work together? She is a single mom, has no partner to share these things with. And we do have the other friend, though, and I know there are other people she could share this stuff with. Maybe she does, I don't know. But the question to you and the show and the audience is, am I a bad friend for feeling like this?
You kind of...
My question is, have you got any real problems in your life?
I don't want to even begin with this.
You don't have to.
She's not going to like what I have to say to her.
Don't be a friend to this person if you don't like him.
Well, wait a minute.
Now, you're at least on the right track, but let me finish her letter. Am I a bad friend for feeling like this? How do I tell her that she's overloading me? Should I even say anything to her? I don't want to hurt her. I love her and usually enjoy her company. Maybe it's the fact that we're at work that bothers me. Sorry to be so lengthy. I am looking forward to hearing your feedback. Thank you kindly. Someone here is self-absorbed, only it isn't your friend. You don't have any room in your life to care about the mundane details of someone else's life. And yet you call that person your friend. That's what being a friend is. Being there when it's not important. If every friend of yours had to be interesting all of the time, then you could just turn on the radio and listen to us. You wouldn't need any.
Well, isn't there a little separation of friendship and work? I mean, when I come in on Monday morning, just about everybody I encounter, I ask, how was your weekend? And usually find maybe a detail or two. If this lady wants to tell you exactly what her kid ate for dinner,
Casey did this. She zeroed in on the other side of this. Go ahead.
You don't have to be friends with her.
Yeah. Cut her off. Fire her.
It's hard. It's like a breakup with a relationship, but you can fire your friends.
Although when you're working right next to them, it's more difficult.
You can fire your friends, but I think Bob's closer to the truth here, and I can't believe they're so different. This lady has nothing in her life. She has nobody.
She even got her job from this girl,
This is a person about a half a box of Twinkies from a suicide.
It's a person who needs you, but if you're this person, you only care about yourself.
Exactly.
So they really need someone who cares about them, so they don't need you. So you'd be doing the universe a favor by doing what Casey suggests.
Now I'm confused.
In a roundabout way, I agree with you.
I know. I'll just take it.
Get rid of this friend because she's not really your friend. You don't sound like you're capable of being a friend.
Well, it's pretty one way on the other friend's part, too. If she just sits down and
hold on. Coming up, we have to take a break, but we're going to open the phones to you guys. And if Kelly's out there, our letter writer, go ahead and call in and defend yourself. I realize I've been harsh on you, but you know what? You're the type of person I'd have no time for because you're all about complaining about you. And you know what? I'm the one who's going to take up that time.
Okay.
You know, we'd be likes and we would repel. I don't know. 1-800-252-1025 if the letter writer is there and if anyone else wants to comment on that. Alan says this.
Good morning, everyone. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Good. Set some boundaries.
Tell her. Set some boundaries. Communicate your wishes.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes if it's affecting work time with 20-minute sessions of ongoing talk, that maybe she's got to set some boundaries. And
I'm good at setting boundaries. I would look at this woman and I would say, hey, you know what? We're working right now, and it's a little distracting to talk in such great detail. And by the way, a lot of the time, you're incredibly boring. Can we talk after work, maybe over a few beers, about how to make you...
You might be better with beer in my...
Well, maybe I would leave the second part out. Thank you very much. Brian in Seattle, go ahead.
Hi, Bob.
This must be Connie. No.
This is Connie, yes, in Des Moines.
Okay, Connie, go ahead.
I said there's a really good 12-step program out there for her friend.
What is that?
It's called On and On and On.
On and On and On. I've heard of that.
Yeah, okay, sorry. That's
okay.
That joke always works.
Only but a good.
Thank you. Brian in Seattle, hello.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good. You know this person?
No. Who's this? Yeah, no, it's my sister.
That's your sister. It sounds like your sister.
My sister will sit and talk about one story, every detail, till she's done, and you can pretty much sum it up in a 2 or 3 sentences. Drives us nuts. So, I mean, we love her. We tell her, you know, hey, can you speed it up a little if we're in a hurry? But if we're not in a hurry, we just sit and listen. That's what family does.
That's what families do. And should be what friends do, or you should unfriend, right?
Exactly.
Thank you, Brian. Paula in Olympia. Go ahead, Paula.
Robert, this is Paula from Saturday Night Show.
Hi, Paula. How are you?
I'm wonderful today, and this is what I sound like after screaming my lungs out for you guys.
Thank you for coming to the Impaler Show.
Fun.
Oh, Spike, sir, you were rocking. And Casey, you were awesome.
Thank you.
And, oh, I know. Hello, Joe. Did I miss a cowbell? Because I brought one with me.
I haven't played cowbell for a while. I'll have to get back out there.
Hey, Paula, is there a point to this story? Are you going anywhere with this conversation?
Are you the lady where the letter's about?
Well, yeah, I could be. Because that woman is actually trying to have a conversation with somebody that she considers her friend that might be able to help her transition to a new state, because she's trying to change her world by telling people her story, even if it's over and over.
You know what? That's another good idea. Help her transition to a new state.
And
Montana
really
would be good.
Look at it that way, because that's what we're going to do, because that's what I've been going through, and I've had plenty of people had to listen to my story for 30 years, the same shit over, but because it was an ironic story, I figured people got a laugh out of it.
All right. That's very good, Paula. Thank you.
I think another tip may be find her a man, because there is a man out there, I believe, for every woman, and a man will put up with a lot of listening.
If he thinks he's having sex at the end of the night.
He may not be hearing, but at least he will put up with some listening.
Last two quickly, because then we have our Young Stud winner, and we have something from Casey. Lori, hello.
Hi. I've listened to you guys for so long. I really, really appreciate you guys in the morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that I'm kind of the same mind that Kelly is, because it sounds like she, you know, when she's at work, she has her work head on. And it's all about work. And, you know, maybe she can't distract herself. She doesn't want the distraction of listening to somebody's, you know, meandering story. And quite often I just have to say, and then, you know, just to try to get somebody to move along with their story. So, you know, I agree.
Agree with what?
Well, I agree that when you're at work, it's about work. But you can, like the one caller said about setting boundaries, I think that's really important.
All right.
You know, you have to be able to say, you know what, this is, I can talk to you after 5 o'clock or whatever time.
Or even if you want to, like, you can also ramp back the relationship. You can say something like, and I've done this, I can talk to you in September.
In September.
Yeah, I've got a coffee open in September. I'll see you then.
Oh, I don't think that's fair.
I know, he's heartless.
I'm a busy man. I'm very busy.
My friends.
People believe I'm busy.
You're giving Kelly grief for having no compassion and being shallow and self-centered, and then telling her to do more of the same thing by dumping this poor person who has nobody else in her life.
Last call from Jim in Bellevue. Hello.
Yeah, hi guys.
What should she do?
Well, I don't think if it were as far as setting boundaries go, this lady probably would have already done that if that was some step that she was planning on taking. For me, I'm the type of person that just kind of let people walk all over me. But what I would do is I would just actively stop listening. You know, you can kind of, there's a ton of people that will just...
So you just say,
Exactly. I mean, it's not like she's talking necessarily to convey anything important, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously that's why everything seems so mundane.
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of... just let it go. Every now and again you stop and you listen, and then you repeat something she said to you right back.
Because this kind of person will never actually ask you to speak.
More than not, yeah.
No,
I think
no.
That would be the case. So, I mean, you don't have to, like, set up a date and be like, listen, we don't need to talk about this right now or something. You know, it doesn't seem like they really...
If they actually hit you with a question, go, oh, you know what? I got to do something right now. Let's pick this up where we left off later.
Exactly.
Perfectly.
You should have to do something else. I mean, it's...
You know what I would rather do than that, though?
Is set a boundary.
No, I would rather... Because I would rather give myself a plasma bath and run naked through the Amazon jungle dodging mosquitoes than that.
Oh, yeah.
Just done.
But thank you, Jim.